Before we get going, our first order of business is to adopt some rules. So,
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the House Interim Committee Rules for Agriculture and Natural Resources.
And these are the kind of standard rules. And do I see any objection to adopting the rules? Hearing none, the rules are adopted. And then I guess just some introductory comments. This is the first time we've met together, so I always like to say when it works out just like it does with Representative Garrard so far to my left. I thought we could start over there.
Very uncomfortable, I might add, but happy to be on the committee with Representative actually this is a very esteemed committee.
It is.
The people we have on it, very knowledgeable, so maybe we can get some things done during the interim. But happy to be here.
Representative?
I'm thrilled to be here with, and Representative Garrard, by the way, gets to sit with me on two committees this session. I keep saying interim, but we're not in the interim. We're just continuing.
Right.
So I'm very excited to be here. I think there's a lot of issues in the work plan that we had discussions during your committee, and I'm really pleased to see that we're going to continue to have the discussions on them because they're certainly ones that we identified that need more work and need more input, so I'm really pleased about that. And I think there's going to be quite a bit of overlap with the work we're doing in the House Energy Committee as well, especially in some of the water issues, agricultural issues, obviously with hybrid poplars that we'll hear today. Water is a big component, so looking forward to working with everyone here.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's another day in paradise. Here we are, and we all want to leave early, so I won't see anyone else.
That did a
bipartisan support.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, and we've always kind of operated at the 10,000-foot level, so it'll be nice to be up in close professional, and certainly learning from my esteemed colleagues about some of these very important issues. So I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. And I just want to say I'm really appreciative of the makeup of our committee. I think we have some great people here who are really interested in doing the right things and making good public policy for Oregon. So I'm pleased with that. And with that, a little bit about our administrators, if you want to say something.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm happy to be here. I staff the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources during the session. That's the drilling of the for the remodel that's going on. And you'll hear lots of other strange noises, I think, during the meetings.
That's not me, Mr. Chair.
And just a reminder, if you have your cell phone on it, it does cause a problem, on it, as I found out earlier today. So that goes up. And committee, our committee assistant, Susan, you want to say anything, Susan? Thanks for being here. So with that, we'll get right into some work. And I guess you heard a little bit from other people talking about it. We had a lot of discussion about issues that were important to Oregon during the last session. And what you see on today's agenda are three of those issues that we will be dealing with again. And then our work plan really goes on to a whole bunch of other things that came up during the session, from the Oregon Trail Bill that I think many people were a part of, the making sure that we kind of gave a directive to the Park Department. We're going to hear from them and see how that's going to aggregate and farmland issues, a whole bunch of issues that continue to be big issues, and we need to continue to have the conversations about them. But today, three of those, and I think as people know with this special session coming up, or the coming up here, November 15th becomes a very big day with respect to getting the information out and then getting your ideas for bills out on the table. So our goal is to have these discussions and continue to work so that we can get those things on the agenda for the next meeting, which is coming up on
November 13th.
So with that, pardon, you're not going to be around.
Been a conference.
So that's right now, and that's getting right to the edge of when that November 15th deadline. So with that, we'll start with what was House Bill 3549, Property Line Adjustment, and Representative Vocals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several of the members of this committee were obviously here 5 months ago when we first raised this issue. In the waning days of the session, the property line issue came up, and what we're talking about is farm and forest lot line adjustments. There was a court decision that actually happened at the beginning of the previous session. We looked at this and tried to figure out a solution to it. There was a base bill that came out in which there was not total agreement on, and then we went to a dash one amendment in which, you know, virtually everybody agreed to, but we wanted to make it better, and went to a dash two amendment, and a few people fell off, and then we went to a dash three amendment. We kind of came back and forth, and we thought we pretty much had a consensus at one point, and so it came out of this committee and went to revenue, and then for several reasons it didn't come out of revenue, none of which didn't have a hearing, and now we're kind of not back at square one, but we're just trying to put that consensus back together. And I think Ron Ebert from LCDC, who's done an extensive amount of work with this, the counties and the cities and both sides of the issue, can bring the committee kind of up to date to where we are, and we believe that we can come up with a consensus over the next 30 days and proceed forward. And I think the counties now recognize in other places that there are issues that they had not originally anticipated that came out of the court case.
And so with that, we'll have a panel if they want to come up forward. So that's Ron Ebert, Art Schlock, and Linda Ludwig. Don't see them.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Schlock. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I am very pleased, we are very pleased that you are looking at House Bill 3549, the issues that it tried to address. As you have already heard, there was a LUBA decision and a Court of Appeals decision that followed that basically, in a way, said that for, although we were interpreting the state law and local processes in a certain way for over 30 years, we were doing it wrong. And that simple lot line adjustments, in many cases, were a partition rather than a lot line adjustment. So where we had situations where a farmer or a forester might be interested in acquiring additional land from adjacent property rather than creating a new tax lot, and they would do a simple lot line adjustment, and 20 acres would be, or 10 acres or whatever, would be transferred from one property to another, and we would go through a process to do a lot line adjustment. Other situations arise where, you know, even though you could have a structure, and it winds up being, once the property is surveyed, on the wrong property, and it behooves one to correct that situation, and lot line adjustments have been used in that situation for, you know, structures. It's been used for fences. It's been used for topographic considerations, and also for where you have a stream, and it might change over the course, and the stream is the property line. There's a need for adjustments, and these have been done administratively without going through a partitioning process for many, many years at this point. So there's a, from a county's perspective, there is a very strong desire to address this issue, which House Bill 3549 proposed to do. In the past couple of months, we've had done a number of district meetings around the state, and I would just indicate to you that this is a problem or an issue in eastern Oregon, in southern Oregon, and in the Willamette Valley and the coast. It's throughout the state where you're looking at managing, shall we say, rural lands. And not to speak for the cities, the concept here is applicable to the, you know, to urban areas as well as to rural areas. It would only take one more appeal to put the urban area a situation where they do lot line adjustment in the same, shall we say, bowl as the rural lands find themselves at this point. So I've given you some examples. Let me give you one more that I became aware of because I got a email from Nikki Witte, who is a commissioner in Coos County. And as some of you may know, as part of looking at putting in a natural gas pipeline, they acquired an old railroad right away. And they, in acquiring that and in talking to the property owners along that corridor, they indicated that they would give to the adjacent property owners the right of way that they didn't need for the establishment of the gas line. And they anticipated they would be able to do that through a property line adjustment. And if this case holds, or if we don't address this, they wouldn't be able to do a property line adjustment and give those adjacent, you know, just amend the property lines and give those people the excess right-of-way at this point. And you don't want to create additional tax lots because the tax lots would not be buildable, and it is not in the best interest of local government, I think, or the state, or the citizens to create new tax lots that would give somebody an idea that this piece of property might be buildable when it's not. So try and give you some reasons why addressing this is important, and why we ought to do it now, because these kinds of situations are around. We were around yesterday, and they'll be around tomorrow. And so there is an urgency to address this issue in February of 08. To that point, I met yesterday with representatives of Lane County and Polk County. Representative Boquist indicated, we need to try and get everybody on the same page. And we thought we'd had, but unfortunately we didn't quite hit the mark. And so there is a renewed effort to get consensus on a proposal that we can bring to you in November for your consideration, and in hopes that you will then take the necessary action to have it drafted. We certainly were looking at the base bill of 3549, and also some of the amendments, and we're in the process of now working with the other interested parties to be able to tell you that we all support a particular concept, and hopefully that will make your job, shall we say, much, much easier, and something that we can do in February of 08. So with that, Mr. Chair, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Any questions? Let's go ahead and have other testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber, Farm Forest Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I would just agree fully with Mr. Schlack. We've been doing this for many, many years, and it's not very often that we actually sit here in full agreement, but this is an issue where, in the planning context, the rubber meets the road. There has to be some flexibility on the ground to deal with these survey errors and things in the wrong place and making simple adjustments on the ground between property. And for a long time that's been done. It hasn't been a problem. The issue that bogged this down, whether or not there are sometimes property line adjustments are made that qualify property for an additional dwelling or an adjacent one, or property is shifted around two or three times and double counted. There's anecdotal evidence of that, and people were concerned, and it may be something we could address. We were very close in the session to reaching a consensus and just ran out of time, and so I would agree with Art that this is an issue that should be addressed sooner than later, and 08 would be the time, and I think we can do it. And the department is in full accord to work with the counties and the cities and the other interest groups to get it done.
Okay. So, questions? Seeing none. I want to thank you, and I do hope that you can keep working this next month and come back with it to us in November. But at least the concept, the more fleshed out the concept, the better it is for all of us. And then I anticipate that in January, probably before a session begins, we'll have a chance to look at those issues and start having the public hearings so that people find out if there's anything we missed. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me.
Representative Gerard.
Just thought of a question.
That's great.
Art, Ron, is there anyone opposed to making this change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, there is nobody opposed to addressing the Luba decision in the Court of Appeals case at this point. The question is what else is included in the fix. It's kind of like a Christmas tree bill. The question is, you know, we got the trunk, and we got a limb. The question is, do we have one limb or do we have more than one limb? I mean, that's the kind of the analogy. But nobody's that I know is opposed to the base issue, correcting that.
Thank you.
I can follow up as Representative Amy. Conceptually, all the whole spectrum of people were in agreement of we need to do something to fix this. And it comes down to when you get into the minute details of whether it's a bud or coming off the limb or whether it's a flower is where we got wrapped up into it last time. And then, as with many things, when we had a consensus of everybody, a few people started thinking about it, and they had too long to think about it, I guess.
You mean that happens in this world?
Especially in land use. Right, I think you know that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I would agree with Art. We were close. I don't think anyone disagrees with the base bill, 3549. We were looking at some dash amendments to deal with some issues that were perceived to be problems that were germane to certain lot line adjustments, and this appeared to be a vehicle for addressing those as well. How real those problems are is a question mark, but some things were possible, and some folks in the process like to preclude things that may or may not really be happening out there just to be safe, and that's what all the discussion was over, without getting into all the gory details.
Any other discussions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We look forward to looking and seeing you next month.
Good. Thank you.
The next subject on the agenda is the Oregon Sustainable Agriculture Resource Center, OSARC. And again, it was one of those things that right at the end of the session, yeah, please come up. A lot of discussions happened and some actions happened, and here we are today to talk about it again. And Representative Clark.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly before our panel gets going, the basic issue in Sustainable Agricultural Research Center is that there are growers who, either by choice of their own or requirements to enter certain markets, Europe, other things, are being are sort of looking at different certifications that they might get. And there's all kinds of different ones. There's, you know, pure organic. There's good agricultural practices. There's the Food Alliance. NORPAC sort of came up with its own. And the question is, how do they find out how to comply? And what we found is a lot of the groups that are in the position of judging whether they're in compliance really are not able to provide assistance on how to get there, because they're the ones that are supposed to be judging, not teaching you how to get there. And so there really isn't a resource for especially small and medium-sized growers who maybe want to get involved in one of these, and it would all be voluntary, where they decide, yeah, I really want to get this Food Alliance certification. I think I might make more money that way. And I had been to one of those several years ago in Hood River. But after that, who do you call, and how do you get a resource that could come out and sort of look at what you're doing and say, well, you're 95% of the way there anyway. So this is an opportunity to essentially assist agricultural growers in a need that is beginning to be more and more, I think, felt. And, again, it's voluntary for the grower. It's just trying to help them have a way to move forward on getting certifications that they might want. There's some other aspects to it, but that's the basic philosophy behind it.
And during last session, this was really came through Ways and Means almost entirely. So it was about a funding bill as opposed to the concept of the bill. So a lot of people in this building didn't really understand what it was. All they knew they were voting on was a budget. So
it was like 10 seconds inside of a Department of Ag presentation in the opening piece, and then just lots of hallway conversations.
And so the discussion here is that maybe it really needs to be opened up so people really understand what we're talking about. So here we are. So with that, I'll give it over to our panel.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Steve Marks here representing NORPAC Foods, an Oregon food processor headquartered in Staten, Oregon. Yeah, this is OSARC 2, the second coming. Return of the good idea. Rick Jacobson apologizes for not being here today. He was very instrumental in the initiation of the OSARC idea as NORPAC growers went through the experience with their stewardship committee of thinking about certifying their products. Today I can tell you that that effort, they're about a third of the way through their membership in terms of certification, somewhere around 72. Those are whole farm certifications, so it's not just the products that are being grown for NORPAC, it's also the products going to other sectors like the nursery industry, for instance. With me is Peter Bloom, and he quarterbacked the Oregon Solutions effort on behalf of the many diverse organizations that that you will see on the list or become familiar with who are part of this membership. My simple purpose in being here is to thank you for this opportunity to discuss again the necessity and need for OSARC. We are very appreciative for your formation of a work group. We'll be meeting tomorrow, I believe, with Representative Clem and Boquist to, I believe. Sorry, Chair. If I
we hope they got the
To outline the basic concept of the legislation. We are very focused on making that simple and understand that direction. There are three core components to it. One is the creation of a board and a way to retain sort of the membership aspects that have surrounded this idea. The other is to provide a service center where farmers can call into for direct assistance in getting the expertise they need to find out about certifications and meet certification requirements. And also, in conjunction with that, the development of a knowledge center or portal, in which we're thinking is a website presence that would provide sort of the detailed expertise on and the certifications right there online. People could actually go to it themselves. And we're thinking of that not only as a use for farmers, but also as useful to the experts from the variety of fields that come together around these certifications. Because, as you know, the idea of certifications takes into account not just what you grow, but how you grow it, and how you take care of the environment as you do that. So it's important, sort of wraps the social components and the environmental components with the economic components to produce sustainability. I would remind the committee that the governor did request OSARC in the budget for the total package, including Department of Agriculture certification positions. It was biannually a $1.1 million request at that time. So another aspect of this will be the budgetary aspect to initiate it. I guess the key and central idea, and Peter will go into this further, is that OSARC was created to serve farmers. Its idea was to serve the farms and the farmers that needed this information and needed this knowledge and needed the expertise to help them take advantage of the programs we have. There's no regulatory component in this, and that's important. And the many organizations that have endorsed this understand that what we're looking for is to have people self-select themselves into the process and figure out the best ways for them to get certifications, which are increasingly important to the marketplace. With that, I just leave you with the notion that you do have a very broad range of organizations, from farmers to agricultural organizations to the state agencies, that have the differing kinds of expertise and knowledge that we need to be together. OSARC will provide a necessary and needed linking function, I think, to get more efficiency out of all the expenditures we make in managing our agricultural resources and our natural resources. And with that, I turn it over to Peter Bloom so he can tell you about how we got to where we are.
Thanks, Steve. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Peter Bloom. I live in Corvallis. My academic training is in agricultural engineering, and I spent most of my career in the extension services of Illinois, Oklahoma, and most recently in Oregon. Mary Lou and I are beginning our 11th year as residents of the state, and we intend to stay. I retired as the Associate Director of Extension at OSU about 5 years ago, and since retiring from that position, I've engaged in consulting and some volunteer work and the work of spoiling grandchildren, not necessarily in that order. One of the most interesting and fulfilling things that I have done during that period was, as Steve mentioned, serve as the project manager of the Oregon Solutions Project to create the Oregon Sustainable Agriculture Resource Center. Governor Kulongoski established that project, again, as Steve said, at the request of Rick Jacobson, who was then president and CEO of NORPAC, and he did that on behalf of the producer members of NORPAC. Thane Dutson, who is Dean of the College of Ag Sciences at OSU, Director of the Oregon Ag Experiment Station, served as the convener of the project. Our first meeting was on January the 28th, 2005. In about three more months, it'll be 3 years that we've been involved. We invited all the interested public and private parties, and the minutes of that first meeting indicate there were 12 people participating. The number of participants has increased as we progressed through several meetings, and from the very first meeting, we began to focus on creating our collective vision for the center, which we quickly began to call OSARC. As that vision took shape, we not only increased the number of members that were involved in the meetings, but also the membership tended to move to higher levels in the participating organizations. And I think the reason for both of those changes was that the vision that we were creating became pretty compelling. But also, as we created that vision, there were some organizations who were not participating in the conversations, and they began to wonder what we were up to. And we decided that it was important that we take the time to engage them in the conversation directly. And it was Rick and Thane who carried most of that responsibility, but that meant that the project took a bit longer than we had originally anticipated. But once we had the vision in place, we began to create the Declaration of Cooperation, and we held a signing ceremony February 16, 2006. There were 27 public and private parties signing the declaration, 13 private and 14 public. Since then, a memorandum of understanding has been put in place as the original organizing structure for the center. Grants have been obtained to support a halftime coordinator within the Institute for Natural Resources. The working groups that form the core of the center have taken up their work. And a skeleton web presence has been created as part of the Explorer Web series. So I'd like to end these very brief comments with my take on what that vision is. And for me, there are 4 points to the vision for the center. The first is that the 27 and now 28 OSARC partners have agreed to put everything they have in one place so that it's available to everyone. That's unprecedented. No one else has done that. No one else is proposing to do it. The second point is, where will OSARC be located? And as Steve mentioned, it'll be in one place, and it'll be in every place. It'll be located at the Food Innovation Center at Portland, but it'll also be in every office of every one of the OSARC parties. It'll be on every computer that has Internet access, on every farmer's computer that has Internet access. The third point for me is that there's presently a huge investment that the state has made in the economic, environmental, and social vitality of our agricultural sector, and that investments made by federal government, by state government, and by the many private parties in the agricultural system. OSARC is the marginal investment that will greatly that will make that larger investment much more effective and much more efficient. And then finally, again, as Steve mentioned, how will we know when OSARC is successful? Well, we'll know by what happens on the ground. From our very first meeting, there were members of our team who kept reminding us that we needed to keep a tractor seat perspective on what we were doing. How will we know? Well, we'll know by the number of producers who get assistance from OSARC. We'll know by the level of satisfaction that they express with the assistance that they got. We'll know by the on-the-ground changes in production and conservation systems in the state. We'll know by the amount of acreage that's under sustainable agricultural production. And we'll know by the capture, that the total capture that we get of this values-added segment of the food system, which is that dynamically growing part of the system that's based on consumers who are making their purchase decisions on factors that go beyond just quality and price. I believe that's a very compelling vision. The OSARC team believes it's a very compelling vision. It's going to take time to accomplish it, and it's going to require the assistance of the legislature. So you have my sincere thanks for taking up this issue in the interim session, and I'd be pleased to try to respond to any questions that you may have.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you. For two questions. One is I actually worked on Sprout, which is
yes.
Oregon mm-hmm. Solutions, which is stands for it's a Sustainable Plant Research Center at the Oregon Garden. So first question was, how does OSARC fit in with Sprout? Because the Sprout is up and going, and it's working on promoting use of sustainable plants for environmental projects, remediation and such. And would Sprout come under OSARC? I mean, there's a little bit of overlap. I know it's focusing more on the nursery sector.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't clear if, I'm assuming the nursery sector would be part of, you know, encouraged to be a partner or as a partner with OSARC.
Well, certainly it would. Steve?
I just say, yes, we want to make sure that this goes beyond food products so that also other agricultural products are a part of it. So I think that's an important component. We talked about that in the outline of the idea around legislation that we'd be considering tomorrow, so that that opportunity would be there for both the food system side of it and then also other agricultural products.
And certainly anything that's learned from the Sprout project can become input into what's available through the Resource Center.
I had a follow-up. Regarding your last comments about what you're looking at the goals, do you have, and I don't know if you haven't done this yet, maybe you did it through the Oregon Solutions process, but I'm not sure that that's the right process to do it. Are you going to be setting goals of how many, you know, you talked about you can tell the success by how many acreage, you know, we're going to have. Are you going to set goals by sector? For instance, you know, for in the food sector, in, I don't know, if we're talking about wheat growing or, I mean, how are we going to assess, as legislators who are helping funding this, the success of this program? And are we going to have measurable outcomes by goals or by, you know, how much we're percentage of the market that we're aiming for? That would be helpful. I know I've seen the work plan probably about 6 months or 8 months ago, and I can't recall if it was in there.
Some of the original work has been, preliminary work has been done on setting the metrics for assessing the success. I think your suggestion of giving attention to that by sector, by agricultural sector, makes a lot of sense. I think that's part of the conversation that's going to be going on tomorrow as in the work group. Mm-hmm. I know that the Department of Agriculture has a memo, which I have seen, where they were doing some of the initial work on what the metrics are going to be.
I guess my question is, so as part of the extension services, are all the extension agents, are they already working with this, and they already understanding that it may be an option of information available to them? Because I think that when I look at a lot of my farmers in the areas mm-hmm. that I come from, they trust the extension agent more than they trust the state, anybody else. I mean, they see that person as a separate person who gives them a lot of good advice with respect to how to go about doing things. And they themselves may not have a computer, but they expect that person to have a computer. And so from the standpoint of phone lines and all those kinds of other ways to get the information out to people, is that all being considered in OSARC?
Yes, and it's not just the Extension Service, NRCS, the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. All of the folks who work with landowners and who work with producers are really folded into the concept. That's why I say we see this as being everywhere. We see it as being on all of their computers. And as we look down the road, we see training programs, too, for the staff members of all of those organizations to be brought up to speed at what's at their fingertips. We think that those people who have worked with producers for a long time will be able to give much more complete information than they've been able to give in the past, because all of that information hasn't resided in one place.
Yeah, just to comment on that part, the time I went on a tour, we were invited by the extension office in Hood River County. So that I felt a lot better going. I mean, I didn't know what the Food Alliance was. I had no idea. And so we went down to the extension office. We met in the parking lot, and we went and looked at some orchards, and they described what this certification was, how if, you know, you were already doing most of it anyway, you could contact them to comply, and then you would have this new market brand that would give you product placement in the stores, potentially more money. The issue was, again, they're a judge of whether you comply, and they don't really have, you know, they're getting an awkward spot to have a consulting arm to help you. And the extension office made the entree, but they're so taxed doing the experimental orchard and other stuff. They're, you know, they're not experts in certification requirements of Europe versus, you know, some other country. But that's how I heard about some of these first certifications in the first place, was the extension, because that is a resource, certainly in each county.
So, any other questions? So, work group, we're hoping again by next month that we'll have some at least conceptually stuff ready for us to proceed to the next step.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I expect that to be, I mean, the legislative product, what we'll put on paper in a bill, I think is fairly simple. I think the excitement around this is the opportunity we'll have to show you what kinds of collaborations are going on and what this entity will facilitate throughout the state, and we hope to have the opportunity to do that at your hearing in November.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So our...
There it is here.
Another one that came up during the last session that sparked a lot of conversation during the session, and I'm pleased to say that we have a group that, again, is working to come up with an answer, and that's on our hybrid poplars. So if we could have our panel come on up, and I guess that's Greg Peden and Ray Wolfson and Christina McNett. I saw you earlier this morning. I didn't know that. That's and Katie Fast and Ted Lorenzen, or whoever wants to come up. Okay, that's fair.
That's always dangerous.
That's true.
You didn't hear me.
No, I didn't.
For the record, I'm Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I provide a little bit of technical information on why something is needed to address this particular issue. As most of you are aware, the Forest Practices Act provides the Board of Forestry considerable discretion to adopt rules to regulate forest practices. There are some exceptions to that that are mainly in statutory language related to certain issues around social issues, clear-cut size and spacing, scenic highways, and in-unit leaf trees, where they don't have much discretion or no discretion at all to modify those standards. So generally, the board's got great discretion with a few exceptions to that. Placed into that is the hybrid poplar growing, where currently, poplar plantations that are grown on a rotation of 12 years or less are exempt from regulation of the Forest Practices Act by basically exempting them from the definition of an operation. So under the Forest Practices Act, they're considered to be forest land, but it says that they're not included within the definition of operation, therefore not regulated under the FPA, so long as they meet a certain set of standards around hybrid poplar growth, and one of the major ones being a rotation of 12 years of age or less. For a number of reasons, the poplar growers are now interested in extending the rotation to beyond 12 years of age, including the reason for producing solid wood products as opposed to pulp, which was the original market target before. So if they go beyond 13 years, they will then fall under the definition of operation and fall within the purview of the Forest Practices Act. So the question becomes, okay, given that, how do we address that particular issue on a technical basis, allowing, assuming the policy choice is made to include them under the Forest Practices Act, appropriate discretion to not apply those standards that might not work well that are in the statutes. And again, the easy example is the clear-cut size and spacing. The Forest Practices Act says in statute that you cannot exceed 240 acres, period. There's no discretion to that, and generally you can't exceed 120 acres unless you meet certain conditions. The hybrid poplar growers have made considerable investment in infrastructure that makes that target of acres impossible to meet. For example, if they're irrigating certain age classes, all got to be watered at the same rate. So, again, the infrastructure's in place. That particular statutory standard doesn't work very well, and certainly in-unit green trees don't work very well either. So it raises the question, how do you address those statutory standards? This group's work to figure out a solution, and the general concept that has been brought for you, I believe copies have been provided to you, I will be provided to you. Basically, gives discretion to the Board of Forestry to address those statutory elements and provide for modification or waiver to those that would be appropriate to address the particular unique needs of the poplar growers. And again, it would provide discretion where the Board of Forestry currently doesn't have it for these particular statutory elements. There are a couple other things we added in there, also in reflection of some broader interests. Again, anytime there are statutory mandates that don't have any discretion, if you're going to provide some discretion, it raises the issue of are there other issues you might want to address at the same time. We did in this draft suggest that for research purposes, or for stewardship agreements, that similar discretion be provided. The stewardship agreement in particular is an avenue we might expect the hybrid poplar growers to actually use to put together a plan that would allow another process of dealing with these particular issues in a broader landscape perspective over time. So, again, that's the stewardship agreement components tied to this overall issue. The research issue isn't, but I think there we're finding that there may be some opportunities to where we want to look at how you might better emulate disturbance similar to wildfire, and having a lead on size may not be a very good approach to that particular opportunity. So this is a discretionary bill. It says the Board of Forestry may waive or modify, and again, our target at this point in time is to provide appropriate dialogue through the Board of Forestry's process to employ that discretion to meet the needs of the various interests, and we think there's general consensus for the concept at this point in time.
Yeah. My name is Don Rice, and I'm a farm manager for Greenwood Resources, and I thank you for the opportunity to be with you here today. The Greenwood Resources has been interested in poplar management since about 1999, 2000, and have recently invested into ownership of some additional properties. When I sat before you last year, I was an employee of Potlatch Company, and that has that ownership has changed and is now managed by Greenwood Resources, and I'm now employed by Greenwood Resources. So Greenwood now manages about 30,000 acres of poplar, and we are also excited about the opportunity to move forward, as was mentioned, into some variety of products. And one of the ways we're doing that is by constructing a mill on our farm in the Boardman-Hermiston area, in which we will be producing some solid wood products, primarily moldings, millwork, trim, those types of non-structural products. Be competing with some of the imported radiata pine into remanufacturers. Our poplar operation is certified, much like we heard earlier, and we're certified by FSC under looking at the same types of things that were mentioned, environmental, social, economic sustainability. The poplar history was mentioned that we started out focusing on pulp production. And as the industry has grown and matured, the need to look at multiple products over time and higher value products has led into transition, where we will not be looking only at pulp, but looking also at solid wood products. And a big area that our company is involved in at this point is also energy, biofuels, cellulosic ethanol. We are participating in grant proposals with a variety of different companies looking at possibility of pilot plant operations of cellulosic ethanol projects. So our interest in poplar is not focused just in one area, but looking at trying to develop its potential in many areas. One of the restrictions in going forward, though, as has been mentioned, is the 12-year statutory limit and some trying to apply some of the specifics of forest practices. If we go beyond our current agricultural definition, The path that we're looking at here is a little different than what we talked about last session in terms of extending the agricultural classification and now looking at trying to work within the forest practices framework and deal with the specifics such as harvest unit size and retention trees. We've been very appreciative of some of the other organizations, Oregon Forest Industry Council, Oregon Small Woodland Association, Oregon Farm Bureau, that have put many hours into this discussion since the legislative session. And the concept that you see before us in taking to the Board of Forestry is the result of those hours of work trying to find consensus and a path forward that would work for the parties involved. I trust that as we go forward, if this passes and goes to the Board of Forestry, that we can continue to work with these groups and others to resolve the specifics for application in the field. This process is probably not an end-all in the discussion. Depending on how the Board of Forestry deals with some of the issues, there may be some related things that will need clarification in the future. The one that comes to mind specifically will be around property taxation. And, you know, it's property that's been taxed historically as agriculture. And so how will it be taxed going forward? And I know the county assessors and county commissioners have interest in this topic, and we'll probably be seeking some clarification in the future depending on how things get resolved at the Board of Forestry level. So it will require some additional work into the future, undoubtedly. I'd like to extend an invitation to the committee to visit our farm and see what we have going on the ground and various aspects of production. And so if you have opportunity, particularly to come to North Central Oregon, the Boardman-Hermiston area, we would very much enjoy an opportunity to give you a tour of the farm. And be glad to try and answer any questions.
We'll go on first. And then
thank you. Thank you, members of the committee, for spending the time with us. My name is Rob Miller. I'm the president of Mount Jefferson Farms, Inc., a company called Environmental Plant Systems, and another company called Miller Forest, Inc. I'd like to speak to you a little bit about how hybrid poplars relate to us. We're located in Salem, Oregon. I'd like to speak for a second or two about long-time public service I've had related to public policy and the consistent theme throughout, and then encourage you to try to support this proposal to go to the Department of Forestry. I'm a third-generation forest products legacy, I guess. My grandfather is responsible, a lot of people say, for the Forest Products Research Center over at Oregon State University, and was involved with a plant to produce in the war chemicals out of Springfield, out of hybrid poplar, or not hybrid poplar, but allwood species at that time. I'm a second-generation forest products legacy in the sense of producing poplars myself. My father, Walt Miller, is pretty much reputed to be responsible for moving the hybrid poplar industry forward in the Willamette Valley, and for many years was the largest poplar buyer in the state and the Northwest, probably in the western United States, of cottonwoods for logs use of all kind. And I'm a first-generation producer of hybrid poplar that's taken it into another generation of use, which is using the material in agroforestry. We're a large farming operation, farming about 4,000 to 5,000 acres on the east side and the west side of the state. We use poplar in agroforestry. We're recognized nationally with an award to do that for bioengineering, for phytoremediation, for stream bank restoration, for water quality uses of all kind, for mixing agriculture and forestry in nursery setting and growing trees in the nursery. For many other reasons, carbon sequestering. We're involved with the largest, I believe, carbon sequestering project in the state of Oregon on the east side and the west side, connecting both, where we use stream bank restoration credits or process where we sold the credits to the Oregon Climate Trust, and I'll go into more detail on that if you want. So it's very important to our agricultural operation. Our target was always on 3,000 or 4,000 acres of agricultural land, to have 400 acres to 1,000 acres, maybe in a mixed agroforestry setting. We've pretty much accomplished that, not to those acreage, and it's been a very economical, viable, and important part of our agricultural and agroforestry operation. A lot I could add to it, but I'll answer questions if that's necessary. Secondly, I would like to say, going aside a little bit, a little different viewpoint on it, I've been involved with public policy in the state of Oregon on the State Higher Ed Board, the Oregon Science Council, Economic Development Department. I've had leadership on all of these positions. I spent 12 to 15 years of my life doing that for one reason, not because I'm very smart, not because I'm very talented. None of that is the case. Part of it I was available, but part of it I was interested in one common theme, which was what really are the strategic advantages of the state of Oregon in a global competitive way? And I have to be honest with you, in all of those years, since 1990, the common theme, whether it was a science council, higher ed work, whatever, many, many other committees, it's always been identified by others that woody biomass, woody products of all kind related to energy, fast-growing rotation trees, fuels, that was always in the top three or four picks. Some of the other ones were metals industry, biotechnology, technology of all kinds. But there is a common theme there. And 20 years, 15 to 20 years of other people identifying the same strategic opportunity for the state of Oregon is not to be discounted here. There is a lot more to hybrid poplar and other fast-growing rotation trees, obviously, than just the production of wood. And I have to say that it's been fascinating but a little bit frustrating to have something that is so ideally suited to the state of Oregon's global and competitive advantage to be tied up in any kind of conflict and controversy when it really doesn't need to be. And we're willing to compromise. We have compromised. We appreciate all of the time that the folks that have a different point of view than us have spent with us. A couple of tours, a lot of meetings. But it's just plain not right to have something that has this legacy of history be stopped simply because there are a few issues that we can't agree on. And I feel very, very strongly about that, wearing a public policy hat. I don't have to grow poplars anymore, and if you don't want me to, I won't. But it's just a fact that this is an important part of the strategic advantage of the state of Oregon. I can talk to you about biofuels. I can talk to you about a lot of things, but I think really I would just like to not bend your ear anymore and basically say we'd like to have your support to take this to the Department of Forestry and throw our lot there. And I think we'll be treated fairly, and I think the state will win. I think we'll win, and I think we'll have a strategic advantage that the world better just watch out for. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to ask a question about sort of the competition around the world and what kind of regulatory guidelines or growing cycles do other forms of government or other states that are interested do? I mean, are we unique? Are we a leader already? You know, is this going to get us into a position where we're on a similar footing to other countries or other states and how they treat it?
Ed Washington.
Chair Roland, Representative Clem, members of the committee. As a complicated question, I'll kind of start from a national perspective and then work out globally, because I think the national perspective is important. Generally speaking, about a dozen states have comprehensive forest practices acts, mainly in the northwest, northeast parts of the country. Those tend to be fairly similar, focused on water quality and certain aquatic habitat components and wildlife habitat components. There are differences amongst Oregon, Washington, and California, but dominantly those states are much more highly regulated than anywhere else in the country, comparatively speaking. As you look at a global perspective, the United States overall is much more regulated than anywhere else in the world. Now, there's some rising of some regulation through a number of other processes like certification, that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, we're much more highly regulated. Canada, some of the other northern European countries are, again, moving into more certification-type approaches that get to real similar outcomes as to most of the forest industry through the United States. But certification is kind of a voluntary process as opposed to the regulatory process. So overall, we're at, I think, a somewhat disadvantage due to the regulation. We're also at somewhat of a disadvantage due to topography. We do have some of the most productive forests in the world, and we do have some species advantages, but comparable to some of the other areas that can grow unique hybrid fast growth plantation forestry, they're way ahead of us in terms of genetics and can produce fiber that double, triple our forest can produce at much, much lower cost. So in terms of plantation forestry, generally speaking, from an economic development standpoint, they're able to outcompete us quite a bit. In terms of the native forestry, I think we're very, very competitive. But again, from a regulatory climate and from an economic perspective, we're similar to a high-cost producer.
Yes, Representative Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ted, Don, Bob, Rob, I don't know which one of you want to answer this, so it's a jump ball. Why did House Bill 3481 not pass?
I think, Mr. Chair, I think it was due to some of the issues around the technical nature of the bill that were questioned in the heat of the session around taxation and a variety of other things that didn't seem to be time to resolve those questions before the session came to an end. And there was, I guess to be fair to some of the organizations, there was some fundamental opposition about the concept of agricultural classification.
I'd like to just spend 5 seconds on Representative Clem's question. The state of Washington, and Ted would be more versed in it than I would, has a 15-year rotation, so they definitely have an advantage over us, state of Washington. And, of course, the likelihood that if we stay at a disadvantage in that to that degree, which is very, very significant with the kind of technology and production that Don is doing and mine as well, might be on a much smaller level, I'm afraid it'll just walk across the street, I mean the Columbia River being the street, to the state of Washington, where we have untold requests from the state of California to send material down. I know exactly what they want to do. Look at what their governor talks about every day. So if we don't do this, what?
You know, it's an interesting question about competition and production. At current trends, Oregon around 2050 will no longer produce as much wood fiber as it consumes. And as a nation, we've not been self-supporting for quite some time in probably the 50s. California's not had enough wood production to meet their needs for a long, long time. Obviously, get wood from Oregon, Washington, and Canada. Washington's now tipped where they don't produce as much wood as they consume. Washington and Oregon produce about similar amounts of total sawn logs. But it's one of those key issues about not just how do we compete, but how do we sustain our own demands. And, again, the intensively managed plantations, whether it's hybrid poplar or conifer, are going to be a tool that really can allow us the luxury of affording other types of forest management and other forest lands. And there's been quite a bit of work articulating, you know, California's exportation of their environmental costs to other places in the world. And, I guess I'd make the point that if Oregon doesn't provide wood for Oregon and this country, it might be likely it'll come from Canada. Well, it takes about 5 acres in Canada to make similar sorts of wood volumes that produce from an acre of Oregon land, and it'll take about three times as long a rotation to produce the same amount of wood back there. So there's some real trade-offs, and obviously I'm not articulating any particularly fishing on hybrid poplar, but I think it's important that we have those intensively managed options to produce wood fiber needs that are really going to have to be met in the longer term. And I think that's an important thing that we're interested in, sustaining all sorts of forestry. Part of the reason why we are suggesting the discretion to the board's process is hybrid poplar plantations, like anything else, have a range of characteristics, and we want to be able to create the opportunity to meet that range of needs while also appropriately addressing the resource protection options that are appropriate for the business as well.
Is there any comments?
I'll hold comments, Mr. Chair.
I'll state one that we've already kind of discussed, and that is that I really do believe that this bill got caught up at the end of the session in a whole bunch of different areas, and I'm pleased that it's back here. But one of the issues I think is going to have to be resolved is the tax issue, because fairness to counties, fairness to everybody else, and fairness to the industry, you know, if it shifts, we really have to, I think, have a clear understanding in January how that's going, or I think it'll be difficult with this bill getting it through, because the people will bring it forward to us. The counties are going to want to know how they're going to fit into that, and so on. So I guess I would encourage you to truly have those discussions before we get back here in the final analysis of it.
If I may, Chair Rowland, I think the approach we're taking here is we, at least from a technical standpoint, the board and department wanted to facilitate the solution of the forest practices issue. And again, we're not really engaged in the taxation, so we certainly are interested in making people competitive, but again, that's probably outside of our our interest and jurisdiction.
Representative Lopez.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think whatever the analysis of what product comes forward, whether it's in principle the legislation that's before us, I think revenue needs to get involved from the perspective of, you know, what's the property tax issue. And, I mean, this is an agreement to agree. I mean, the draft piece of legislation is really an agreement to agree that we'll do something to implement this further down the line.
Right.
And I think the base issue that came back around before had to do with, if it's ag property, it's taxed one way, and if it's forest property, it's taxed the other. And I think regardless of what bill comes out and they come to a consensus, it's fairly easy to get LRO to say, okay, if they did it this way, this is the result, and if they did it this way, it's that result. I'm doubtful the Department of Forestry or even the Department of Agriculture would be in a position to analyze that, but I think LRO can look at it very quickly and say, if it were treated as a property tax for forestry, this is how it works, and a property tax for agriculture. I think, you know, regardless, the committee needs to go forward. We need to have a solution for this, and we need to get moving on it yesterday.
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So we do have a few others who would like to come up and... Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. And as was indicated previously, we, along with the Small Woodlands Association Farm Bureau, have been working on this issue since the session and continuing discussions about what the solutions might be. Our board met last week, and this issue was on the agenda, and this concept, Ted Lawrenson was kind enough to come and talk with our board about this idea, and they're comfortable proceeding with this option, and believe that the Board of Forestry is in the right place to adjudicate some of these specific issues that relate to forest practices and what should apply where and what might be exempt in certain circumstances. So we're fine with moving this forward for the February session if that's the will of the committee and the body.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I represent the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'm pleased to report to you that, unlike prior to last session, we have had the opportunity extended to us by the proponents of this legislation to actually sit down and have conversations. and talk as industry colleagues about their proposals and how they do business managing hybrid poplar versus how some other more traditional forest landowners operate. I think that philosophically one thing I'd like to share with this committee that hasn't really been explicitly stated yet is that from the perspective, at least from the small woodlands, we are sympathetic with the frustrations of operating under the Forest Practices Act. It's not easy, and it's not cheap. But the fact of the matter is the Forest Practices Act is not and never has been an act to facilitate forestry. It's an act that protects public resource values. And Ted Lawrenson mentioned some of those, being fish and wildlife and water and habitat. And so as a community, I think we had an extreme paranoia, maybe you could say, but I think based on history, that if you have some sort of a carve-out or an exemption, which we have had as a state for poplar at 12 years right now, if we just magically move that number from 12 years to 15 or 12 years to 20 or 12 years to 30, why does that make that a valid policy decision, or why does it not? I don't think that we can answer that. We can't answer what does this poplar plantation provide in the way of resource values that weren't there before the plantation existed. And I think that this agreement, what you have before you, puts the question at the right place for scientists and silviculturists and Board of Forestry members to carefully consider what modifications they can make to the Forest Practices Act to facilitate the hybrid poplar situation and some other situations without compromising Oregonians' faith in the Forest Practices Act, because Oregonians view that's our social contract to continue forestry. And if we take a step where we carve out exemptions that may or may not protect those public resource values, all of us are in danger in the future. So I think that has been the tough nut for all of us. I'm pleased to say that our executive committee met last Friday, reviewed this proposal, and we are comfortable supporting that in January and moving forward. There are some outstanding tax issues. I think it's not as complicated. Well, it is complicated, but it's complicated on a county assessor level, and we've suggested to the proponents that there is a county assessor association and that they might be well advised to work with that group prior to, you know, introducing future legislation so they don't run into the same type of buzzsaw that they did on this policy question. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Just like to add Farm Bureau's acceptance to this language. I want to thank Ted Lawrenson and the Department of Forestry because our associations met with the agreement with the Poplar group on some proposed language. Department of Forestry took a more global look at that language and added the suggestions in for the research projects and the stewardship agreements. And I appreciate that kind of stepping back from the conflict issue and seeing how legislation can benefit other areas that might need it. And so I think we'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Okay. Any questions?
Sort of a question comment, but since I was one of the few, you had like a turnover of, I don't know what you did to scare everybody off this committee, but for those of us who have been working on this since last session, I mean, the three major issues that came up, the taxation issue that we talked about, the regulatory issues, and then, you know, looking at market competitiveness. The question, I guess when I look at, you know, whether we're going to regulate it, growing hybrid poppers as a forest product or as an agricultural product, to me it's about protecting water quality. So whether it's under the Forest Practices Act or under Senate Bill 1010 or Water Quality, Agricultural Water Quality Act, for me it's making sure that we're going to meet those standards and goals, whether it's under Department of Ag or Department of Forestry. And we may want to have the Department of Agriculture come up here and talk about that. So my question was, and I didn't have a chance to run over and look at the statute here and what the references are. I don't see anything in here that says that if it's not going to be subject to the Forest Practices Act, then it, I mean, basically subject to Senate Bill 1010, Water Quality Agricultural Act. And I'm just assuming that's the case because that's currently what they're subject to. Is that correct, Katie?
And Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder, just to make clarification, so Poplar operations that are still operating under the current, if this were to pass, under the current system, so they're harvesting under 12 years, they're marketing in the pulp and paper, they would be subject as ag land still, so they'd be under Senate Bill 1010. There's no change there. What this does is it puts those operations that are harvesting between 13 and 20 under the Forest Practices Act. So I think from our perspective, there's not a change there. It just adds those operations from 13 to 20 years into the Forest Practices Act.
So just follow up.
Yep.
So that means hopefully the goals are consistent for the Forest Practices Act and Agricultural, or Water Quality Act, but they are different requirements. So how is a grower going to balance that then? So there's that's what I'm trying to get here. Are they still subject then to both requirements?
Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder, where the majority of the issues have been is dealing with harvesting. And so your harvest time would predict that. There would be some issues dealing with spray management, which Ray is more of the expert on in Forest Practices Act details. But most of the conflict areas have been in harvest. So you would know if you're going to harvest under 12 or in the 13 to 20 range.
If I could comment on that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, if this bill passes and the hybrid poplar rotation exceeds 12 years, those plans and those operations will be subject to the Forest Practices Act. And the bill would allow the Board of Forestry to modify the rules if they are convinced that modification is justified based on what you just said, which is the purposes of the Act to protect the public resources. And that's one of the reasons we're confident that are comfortable with deferring this decision to the Board of Forestry, because that's will be their starting point. You know, what's being proposed, if we agree with what we're being asked to do, will that have a negative impact on public resources that the Forest Practices Act is on the books to protect? And that'll be the question. If they can't answer that question to their satisfaction, they won't do it. Can I make one more comment about the tax issue and the forest practices issue, just so people know if you don't? The Forest Practices Act applies to harvesting of trees for commercial purposes regardless of the zoning of the land or what the property tax status of the land is. If you've got three trees in your backyard and you cut them down and keep one for firewood and sell the other two, you are required to comply with the Forest Practices Act regardless of the zoning. It seems to me that would permit the legislature to separate these, compartmentalize these issues. Whatever the tax issue is, and I'm not sure I understand what it is, but it can be handled separately from the Forest Practices Act, because there's no linkage in terms of how the land is zoned or the property tax classification that applies to the land. It has to do with if there's a commercial forest operation, then the Forest Practices Act applies regardless. So unless I'm missing something, I'm not sure there's any need to necessarily have those issues continue to be linked. I think they can be dealt with separately. That doesn't mean that they're not both legitimate. They just don't, they're not necessarily have to go together or not. In my view, at least.
Mr. Chair, could
yes.
I add one more thing on
Please.
Taxes? And this isn't on property taxes, but on harvest taxes. And so we're talking about a completely different animal now. It's right. Got polka dots instead of stripes. But one of the additional exemptions that hybrid poplar now enjoys is that if your trees are 12 years and under, you do not pay a harvest tax at the time of harvest. And that was another issue that was a bit of a rub last session. And you'll notice that that's not in the proposed language now, which means that if you harvest over 12 years, you will be paying the harvest tax. And so that issue has been resolved by not actually being in the bill.
Okay, that makes me feel better.
Other questions?
Thank you very much. And just a point of information for members who are new to this committee, this became an issue really for 08 because we have poplar plantations who are right at that age. I mean, they're between now and the next session, they will have to make that decision, and or they would have to harvest all their property to comply with the 12-year requirement. So it does meet the requirement that we've been asking about. Is it something we need to take care of now? And I think it is definitely one of those things. So I agree with Representative Boquist in the fact that we do need to do something, and this is the time to do it. So we will be looking at, again, the proposal, and it looks like it's pretty much fleshed out now, but for our November meeting to make sure that we put it on to get the bills written that we need to do. So I appreciate everybody getting together and talking to each other. I think that the fact that that didn't happen before the last session was part of the issue as much as anything. And with
I appreciate it, because I had pledged that for whatever reason it couldn't happen, I'd have to delve really deeply into everything. And since that time, I found that my wife and I are expecting, and you could have deprived my new infant to be of massive parental time if we hadn't got this hashed out. So I'm incredibly excited.
So, any other comments on this issue? We will move on to sudden elk death. One of the issues that came up a little bit during last session, but is lurking much more prominent in our state right now. So we'll give them a few minutes to get set up here. Yeah, I know. Yeah, we'll take a 2 or 5 minute recess while we're getting ready.
I'm the program director of the Private Forest Program at Oregon Department of Forestry. And with me is Morgan Allen, who's the manager of our Monitoring and Insect and Disease Program, and Nancy Osterbear with the Department of Agriculture. And I'll let them, they're the, they said,
science nerds,
but I think of them as geeks, which is a much more complimentary term. So I'll let them go forward with their presentation.
And just for a second, I just think it's really nice of you that you guys take on the issue of sudden oak death, and it's a forest product. Where's the forest department here? No, I'm just
here. We are. We're here together.
We noticed you didn't touch poplar in the 10-foot.
We didn't jump up here for poplar.
Got news for you. It's coming back.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you so much for this time to discuss this important issue. For the record, my name is Margan Allen. I'm the manager of the Forest Health and Monitoring Program with the Department of Forestry. Nancy and I will go back and forth a bit during this presentation. I'll be discussing things, of course, focused on forestry, and Nancy will discuss things more regulatory and related to industries outside of forestry. Just to get us all focused on where we're speaking of, we're talking about Southwest Oregon in Curry County outside of the city of Brookings. Sudden oak death is caused by the pathogen Phytophthora ramorum. It's new to science, and it's considered a non-native species, though its origins is that it's not known at this time. It's a water mold related to brown algae, and unfortunately it's well adapted for aerial spread. It can survive in a multitude of different kinds of environments, including water, soil, and a variety of plant materials, and it thrives in mild, moist environments. It has a very extensive host list, but just to bring you up to speed on the most familiar ones, tan oak is the one that is most readily killed here in Oregon, as I'll focus on that, as well as, but there's other species that you might be familiar with, particularly Douglas fir, rhododendron, evergreen huckleberry, and they only experience foliar damage. They're not killed by this disease. Not treating sites is not legally an option at this point. There is an OAR that requires treatment, and the one I've cited is particular to wildlands, but is also required in nurseries and in urban landscaping environments. We've been battling this disease since it was first discovered in 2001. What the image is showing you in the map is the tan-colored areas, which were previous infestations that have been treated with eradication treatments, as well as the yellow spots, which are showing the new 2007 sites that we've detected.
The greatest success of our program occurred from 2001 to 2004, but then with a series of warm, wet, mild spring conditions, we saw infestation levels in both the number of tan oak and the number of acres return back to initial infestation levels. The numbers that we have there for 2007 are preliminary, but I expect that they will be comparable again to 2006 levels, and we are still collecting data at this point. Still, despite setbacks, we think this program is effective. Our most readily available case study is a comparison to Humboldt County in California. They both started, their initial infestations were discovered in 2001 with 40 acres in Curry County and 2 acres in Humboldt County. Since that time, and the important thing to note is that there is no control occurring in California. There's no disease management program in that state and no requirement to treat for the disease. As of 2007, the preliminary numbers project that infestation in that county to be at 4,500 acres, whereas we maintain it at less than 200 acres here in Oregon, specifically 168 acres, and have actually successfully eliminated it from some sites. So in other sites, it remains present in the soil, but not detected in foliage. The bulk of our program is focused, of course, on 2 areas, monitoring and eradication. Our monitoring consists of one significant part is our aerial survey program. We do both statewide aerial surveys. That's a normal survey we do for insect and disease, which could pick that up in areas outside of Curry County. We also do 4 checks per year specific to sudden oak death, which are to identify dead and dying tan oak trees, and that's what those yellow dots are representing. We have identified those from helicopter and airplane and visited every single one of those points on the map. It's a very extensive monitoring program. And then it's further backed up by our stream baiting program. We have 65 sites because the spores from this disease do survive in water. This is an excellent pre-detection tool, and both of these tools that we use is how we can say with confidence that sudden oak death is specifically located in those areas on the map within quarantine or just outside of the quarantine area. So we don't think it's rampant everywhere. The eradication costs since 2001 to treat 1,300 acres have cost $1.9 million. Historically, the bulk of that was picked up by federal funding, though particularly last year, state funding kicked in and raised that balance to make state become a significant contributor. What this means is that there's been little or no direct cost to private forest landowners. That federal funding is uncertain. There is no specific set funding source for sudden oak death. And when we compete, when we ask for funding, it's competitive, and we're in competition with national priorities such as wildfire and other invasive species such as emerald ash borer. Should we end up in a no or low funding situation, this would put a significant economic burden on forest landowners who suddenly have to take on eradication costs. I'll let Nancy touch in detail on, in more detail on impacts to nursery and other industries. But we would readily expect the loss of tan oak. We would expect it to spread throughout the range of tan oak, which is shown in the green there on that map, and potentially the loss of tan oak, not unlike Dutch elm disease. You would see, as illustrated in that photo from West Sonoma County, California, a number of hazard trees, elevated fire risk, the accompanying aesthetic issues, loss of cultural resources, and, of course, countywide quarantines if you do not have an active eradication program. The ecological impacts, hard to put exact, but you would definitely have a decrease in forage from loss of acorn from tan oaks, cover, and nesting.
to focus some on forest industry, economic impacts. There's at least three counties in Oregon that have tan oak and could be put into county-wide quarantines, and those counties represent 11% of the timber harvest volume in Oregon. The tan oak chip market in southwest Oregon is already pretty fragile and cyclical, and basically having the quarantine imposed in this area eliminates that market. And where tan oak takes up a significant amount of the constitution of a stand, the composition of a stand, that could eliminate that as a potential stand for harvest. I know that in South Coast Lumber that they're already eliminating stands that they would readily have already harvested outside of the quarantine area. Another major thing to consider is simply the fact of the perception of tainted Oregon forest products. Oregon forest products represent, in lumber alone, $1.6 billion in domestic sales and $20.8 million in international sales. What those graphs are showing on the right, I wouldn't expect you to look at those in detail, but the intent of those, there's been a number of different risk modeling efforts done by different organizations. And what I want you to home in on is the fact is that though in different extents, there is always red in the eastern hardwood forests. There are species at risk over there throughout the eastern hardwoods, with, again, potential for species loss, and, of course, the timber industry there that represents over $30 billion. And right now, APHIS estimates that the regulatory impacts to California's redwood and Douglas fir industry from specifically sudden oak death quarantine at $50 million a year. That's focused within our own borders. This is showing the areas internationally that could be at risk to sudden oak death. They certainly don't want this disease, and we have no control or very little feedback on what different countries choose to impose, either through perception of the risk or real science of the risk. I'm going to hand this over to Nancy now to talk about the proposed expansion of the quarantine boundary and more about the nursery impacts.
Hi, my name is Nancy Ostbauer. I'm the manager of the Plant Health Program with Oregon Department of Agriculture's Commodity Inspection Division. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this, Chair, committee members. As Marianne said, we are planning on proposing an expansion to the quarantine area in Curry County. What happened this past year is we had five sites that jumped outside of our existing quarantine boundary, made jumps of about 3 miles on average. So what we are proposing to do is to expand, and Morgana is helping me with a little highlighter. Mm-hmm. We are proposing to expand the quarantine boundaries out about 3 miles in every direction. That will take it, from the Pacific Ocean roughly to the Calamiopsis Wilderness area and down to the California border, and then just a little bit south of the Pistol River to the north. For the first time, we will have businesses that will actually be within the quarantine area and be affected by the regulations. What that means is that the dozen or so nurseries within the quarantine area are going to have to meet much more onerous requirements in order to ship their products out of state. If they don't grow host stock, it's not going to be that bad. They just have to undergo an annual inspection and certification in order to send their stuff out. But if they do have susceptible plants at their nursery, they not only have to have the annual inspection and testing, they also have to have monthly inspections, and they have to sign a compliance agreement that says they're going to take certain precautions to make sure they don't become infected. This is, based on the experience we've had with some other nurseries, this is a significant impact and causes a pretty major change in how they do their business. The timber industry will not be quite as affected because Douglas fir is not considered what's called a bole host. It means it doesn't attack the main stem of the tree. But those Douglas fir logs have to be free of soil and foliage before they can move out. Depending upon where South Coast might be shipping, this could mean that their customer may require to either debark the logs, which adds quite a bit of cost to the production, or that they just pressure wash them and make sure that they're free of this material, which still adds some cost. The forest greenery company that's down there is also going to have to treat all of their materials before it can be shipped out. Or if they want to try to bring in some other materials to work with, they're still going to have a compliance agreement in place, regular inspections to make sure they're staying within the compliance agreement, and have to jump through quite a few hoops to stay in business. Now, besides what's been going on in Curry County, we have been looking for Phytophthora morum elsewhere in the state. We had the great joy of being one of the first states to find Phytophthora morum in the nursery industry back in 2003, but 2004 was really kind of our ugly year. That's when a large nursery down in California, the disease was found in this nursery, and they shipped to, I think, all other states within the U.S., and we ended up with something like 176 different spots throughout the U.S. where they had shipped infected plants to. This caused, as Margan said earlier, there's a lot of interest on the East Coast in keeping us out of their eastern hardwood forest. So this caused a great deal of concern and prompted USDA to impose a federal regulation on us that we had to inspect all of our nursery stock before we shipped it out. So we've been doing that for the past several years. We have a very low level of Phytophthora morum within our nursery industry, but we still have to inspect all of these nurseries every year that are shipping out of state. We've been lucky so far. We've managed to eradicate it wherever we found it. Because Phytophthora morum also attacks Douglas fir, it also attacks Grand fir and some of our Christmas tree species, we had to survey our Christmas tree plantations as well. We surveyed from 2002 to 2006. We did not find any diseases in our Christmas tree plantations, so we were able to use something that's called pest-free or free-from status so that they can continue to ship their products fairly easily. But to maintain that free-from status, we do have to survey them every 2 to 3 years. Now, this past year, we changed up how we did our nursery surveys just a little bit. We did the annual certification survey that was required by the federal rule. But we also started doing what we are calling high-risk surveys. We learned through basically the School of Hard Knocks that rhododendron growers and camellia growers are most likely to have Phytophthora morum if anybody's going to have it in your nursery. I think 80% of the nurseries that we found it on those two hosts. So those growers have undergone additional inspections this year, and I'm happy to say we haven't found any morum there, but they're still considered at high risk. There's also a good chance that those high-risk surveys are going to be added to new federal regulations. So what happens in a nursery once the disease is found? Well, they have to undergo something that's called a confirmed nursery protocol. This is required by USDA APHIS. All susceptible plants within the nursery are put on hold, so essentially the nursery is shut down until we can go in and do surveys and find out exactly which plants are infected. We then destroy those infected plants, and then we have to monitor it for a set period of time to make sure we got everything. We also have to do what are called trace-out investigations. That means we have to look at the nursery's records, find out how the disease may have come in and where they may have shipped infected plants to. Needless to say, some of these nurseries do a lot of trade, so we're looking at stacks about 6 inches high of paperwork that we're going through trying to figure out what's going on. The other thing about eradication in nurseries, as Margan hinted at a little bit, is that it's the nurseries have to bear the entire cost of eradication if the disease is found there. The landowners down in Curry County have been very fortunate, I think, in that federal funds and such we've been able to use that in order to do work down there, but the nurseries aren't quite so lucky. These are just three examples from 2004. We had a large nursery where they ended up having to destroy about $1.3 million worth of stock. When they penciled it out later, they figured out that just doing that in terms of the personnel costs, the equipment rental, incineration costs, and all that, it cost them an additional $2 million just to destroy the plant material. We had a second large nursery. They got off a little bit easier. They didn't have quite as many plants they had to destroy, but they still lost about $80,000 worth of stock. The cost just for the bill at Brooks Incinerator was $8,000. They didn't share with us how much it cost in terms of personnel, equipment rental, and such. And we did have one nursery that ended up going out of business because they couldn't handle the cost of doing the eradication. So Phytophthora morum, if it's in a nursery, it can have a very severe impact. Now this is what happens when you work on a Macintosh and translate it onto a PC, first of all, because all my graph lines disappeared. But this is what our funding level has looked like for Phytophthora morum over the past several years. And in general, this program costs us between $1.2 to $1.3 million per calendar year. About three-fifths of that is paid for by federal fund dollars. The rest comes out of nursery licensing fees and a little bit of general fund. The you know, we've been lucky the last few years that the funding level has stayed fairly stable, but in talking to the National Program Director, the Federal National Program Director for Phytophthora morum, he is expecting the federal funding to support the nursery side of it to decrease to about half of their projected need in 2008. So we may be scrambling a little bit to find some way to keep our nurseries exporting their product. He has no clue what's going to happen beyond 2009, but because we're having so many other invasives, the same issues they're facing in forestry with emerald ash borer and some of these other invasives, you know, money going to those programs, we're facing the same thing on the agricultural side, that money is being directed to other programs and less of it is coming to Remoral. In all likelihood, assuming that federal funding goes away, the nursery industry is going to have to bear the cost then of having us do the certifications and such. We are trying to take a little bit of proactive approach to addressing this issue now. We've been working with the Oregon Association of Nurseries and Oregon State University Extension Service to develop something that's called a grower-assisted inspection program. It's really a pilot program that's designed. It's going to be voluntary in nature. A nursery has to choose to do it, but it's an audit-based system that where the nursery sort of takes the responsibility to keep their stock clean and keep themselves free of Phytophthora morum, and we go in and just make sure they do what they say they're going to do to try to stay clean. Because we have this certification survey going on in the background, we should be able to actually quantify and see if this really works. We're hopeful that if this program is successful and it provides enough security that our customers are and USDA is happy with it and says, okay, you know, this is a good program, that we may actually be able to go to this program rather than having to do the certification work. I'll knock on some wood because I might be dreaming a little bit, but I really hope that works. We're also hopeful that if this system works for Phytophthora morum, we can use it for other invasive pests, either within the nursery or within other grower industries that we might have within the state. So some of the changes that we're looking at ODA for 2008, we're expecting to expand the quarantine area to 166 square miles from 26.25, I think is what it was originally. We actually have already started the paperwork for this, so it's going to be wending its way through the rulemaking process here very quickly. We are going to continue to help the nurseries meet the regulatory requirements they need to in order to ship their products. We have some concerns about funding for that for next year, but we'll figure out a way to do it. We're also going to continue to work with OAN and OSU to develop this grower-assisted inspection program that we hope will not only be useful for Amor, but can be used for other pests as well. And like forestry, we're very concerned that the federal funding is starting to go away. This is going to put quite a bit of a burden on industry in order to keep this program going if we have to keep going at the level that we're at. And we have concerns that with the eradication program in Curry County may no longer be sustainable. And if we lose that management effort, if we stop trying to eradicate Phytophthora morum in Curry County, then the USDA will quarantine us at the county level. They will no longer do just a small area. It'll be the whole county that will be affected.
So going back to the ODF monitoring and eradication program, our projected need for funding to continue the eradication program and with some into the future, including the 2008 monitoring program, is projected at $879,000. We cannot complete eradication of existing sites with current funds. Those sites will continue to be a source of disease to cause new infections. We do have two federal grants pending and do plan to approach the E-Board in February to help make up for some of this loss. Now, you may laugh at this slide title. If money were no object, we can dream. We would seek to improve eradication effectiveness by not only continuing our localized eradication, intense eradication treatments, but add in large-scale preventive treatments. This is
conceptual at this point. You can see this happening as large areas where tan oak is removed to act something like a buffer that could be done by hand application of chemicals, mechanical removal for biomass utilization. Those would all be possible options. Another option could be aerial application of fungicides, specifically phosphonates, which really are a very benign fungicide on the scale of fungicide toxicity, which would help to prevent infection or minimize spread. So what we are urging is support for the ODF eradication and monitoring program for sudden oak death, because it represents a significant ecological and economic risk to the state of Oregon and the eastern United States. But keep in mind also that sudden oak death represents the economic and ecological damage of just one invasive pathogen. There's a whole array of animal, plant, and other pathogens and insects that Oregon is already exposed to and will continue to have the risk of new exposure to, and the need to support the broader control eradication effort ongoing with invasives in general. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Looking at your second bullet right there on the conclusions, can you give us an idea of what has been the impact of the federal quarantine in Humboldt County in California?
I can't tailor it specifically to Humboldt County. I can only refer you back to the earlier value that I put on the entire redwood and Douglas fir industry estimate by APHIS at $50 million a year. I could inquire if there are statistics available, but I'm unaware of any at this time.
Well, I'm assuming, based on your presentation, that Humboldt County has been quarantined by the federal government. What does that quarantine look like? And
it is it's a countywide quarantine.
Meaning?
They can't export.
So Humboldt County is exporting absolutely nothing? No nursery products? No?
No,
I'm going to jump in on this one because I think Mark Ann would appreciate that. Chair or Representative Boquist, what the federal quarantine entails is that if your entire county is quarantined, if you are growing what is called a boll host, that means something like tan oak, you cannot export from the county unless it has undergone specific treatments. If you are growing something like Douglas fir, you can export it, but you have to meet that requirement where the log is free of soil and foliage. So you have that added cost of you have that added cost of getting your product ready and able to ship and be certified to ship. If you're growing nursery products, you have to have the annual inspection and testing, and you also have to have monthly inspections. I am not certain how California handles that. I don't know if it's all paid for out of federal fund dollars or if nurseries have to pay some of the cost for those inspections. So I do know that they are still able to ship product, but they have had to change their practices in terms of how they organize their shipments, how they get things set up. In some cases, if they have Phytophthora morum, let's say you have a nursery over here, and right next to it is a stand of tan oak that has Phytophthora morum in it, that's disease. The nursery has to take very specific, they have to change their cultural practices, take very specific actions to protect themselves from becoming infected with Phytophthora morum. They may even have to undergo more inspections than the monthly inspections in order to keep shipping their product. That adds quite a bit to their production costs because they're doing fungicide sprays, they're doing regular monitoring. That's the sort of thing that they have to do. Even if the nursery is here and the nearest infected tan oak is 50 miles away, because they're in the same county, they still have to do a lot of the same stuff. They still have to do the monthly inspections. They still have to do the annual inspection with testing. They still have to sign the compliance agreement that says they'll take certain measures to protect themselves. It's just because they're within the county line, even if they're like 50 miles away, they still have to do that. So really, no matter where you are in the county, it's just a matter of how close you are to infected trees, how much your production costs go up. I don't know if that helps.
Let me digress a little bit and go the opposite direction. How is this transmitted?
mean, obviously, we started in 2001. There's nothing. There's 2 acres in California. We've had a 2,200 or 2,300% increase in California over a six-year period. It's spreading rapidly down there. How is it transmitted across the nation?
Chair, Representative, to answer your question, the primary means of long-distance transport, like you're talking about across the nation, is through infected nursery stock. That was unfortunately shown quite well in 2004. Natural means of dispersal is primarily through rain splash and perhaps other aerial means of spread. We're still determining how that's done. The purpose of the federal regulations is to stop that man-made transport, so to speak, of this disease, or the human-assisted spread of Phytophthora morum by looking at this known vector, which would be infected nursery stock.
Okay, so we've got California who's doing nothing, and a federal quarantine that has some sort of impact. At some point, the dam breaks in California and rolls across the border into Oregon, and regardless of what you're doing, we have a problem. So, I mean, has there been interstate compacts agreed upon between California and Oregon? I mean, we're frankly, even from a scientific point of view, operating in a vacuum in there. I mean, we're treating this in Oregon. California is doing nothing, per se. Nature doesn't work in a vacuum. You guys are scientists, right? So tell us what's going
to
happen here.
Do you want to take that? You want me to?
Sure. I'm Representative Bolquist. They actually have started to take, let me answer that in multiple ways. There is surveying that does go on in Northern California. So we know if and where Phytophthora ramorum is going to show up in Northern California. It has not shown up at this point. They also have stream baiting sites with host leaves to test in the lab to determine if it's present in the streams as well. Secondly, the California Department of Forestry, they are trying an experimental kind of measure, a Maginot line, so to speak, where they have a natural species bottleneck. I've forgotten the name of the river that's occurring on, but they are planning on doing, or may have actually already started, large-scale herbicide injections into host species to try to create a barrier to the northward spread of sudden oak death.
We're just so you know, the Germans went around the Maginot Line.
Yeah. Maybe it's not the best analogy.
Just to add a little bit to your question, Representative Boquist, the University of California Extension Service in Humboldt County as well is trying to work with individual landowners to get them to take some kind of action. And I know that the extension agent involved has the support of the timber industry down there as well, because they don't want to see this move any more than it has to. And I would like to say that in 2001, I offered to write a grant for a giant chisel that I could just go right around the edge of California and push it off in the ocean, and no one would do it with me. So I tried.
So while just to add one more thing, so while we do not have any formal agreements, we have an excellent amount of communication that occurs between California and Oregon specialists, and their timber industry in Northern California is very interested in being proactive in taking care of this disease.
And also I think we should add too that we realize that Mother Nature in a lot of ways is a lot smarter than we are, and we know that in some ways we are fighting a holding pattern until we can get better tools in place to manage this disease. And if California doesn't, you know, fortunately they are taking some action now, but if they give up the ghost and just let it run up the coast, we know that eventually we're going to see something really ugly coming our way. But we are hoping that by doing what we're doing, we will have the time for the researchers to develop the tools for us to be able to, if nothing else, live with this disease and have it have much less of an impact on us than it's having right now.
So the one slide says Oregon Administrative Rule 603, et cetera, eradication is required California doesn't have an eradication requirement.
Representing Clem, that's accurate. They do not.
We need to get Arnie on this.
I know. Well, this is my area. That when you look at the map, that's in Perry County. That's mostly federal land.
Well, to the east, that is federal land. That's correct. To the north and northwest, we're talking about a mixture of BLM and private. But it's currently, and ironically, I say South Coast Lumber wouldn't agree to me, but I would say with me, what I would say, fortunately, it's mostly happened on private land and a very proactive landowner to their credit.
Right. I mean, and the reason I'm asking that question is that the federal government has not been real proactive with their management of disease on their property, which makes me very concerned. I mean, they've given us some money, but are they letting us go in to take care of this stuff?
They have been, and I know that they are working, their pathologists are working very hard within their agencies to promote this as an issue. And to be, I am forgetting if it was the BLM or the Forest Service who actually has a pot of money set aside. Do you recall?
The BLM has money that's dedicated for dealing with invasives, but the Forest Service is working on trying to get the paperwork in place in case they have to deal with NEPA and such.
Mm-hmm.
So they are taking those steps. They're trying to get ready for when they may have to deal with it on their land.
Sounds like they pay 60% of
the. Yeah, I appreciate the fact that they're paying a lot of it. That is appreciated. We lost the equivalent. I don't think we ever got in the battle with the Port Orford white cedar and the
root
rot. And that one's kind of eradicated the species.
Chair Roland. I would say that in that disease, we're more in a managerial management kind of a level because there were resistant trees found. So I would not say that species is now at risk, and there are also best management practices, sanitation measures that are taken and regularly used in forestry to minimize the spread and maintain that species.
Is it the same management that this one with respect to the cleaning your equipment and that kind of stuff? Same procedures necessary?
That would, yes, basically, cleaning equipment. I couldn't speak to cleaning the logs.
Chair, to answer your question, a lot of the management practices, the organism that causes Port Orford cedar root rot is in the same genus. It's basically very closely related to the organism that causes sudden oak death. So a lot of the management practices that work against Port Orford cedar root rot will also be effective against sudden oak death just because of that relatedness. There are some measures we're having to take that are a little bit more unique to sudden oak death, particularly the cleaning of logs and such, because it is aerial borne much more so than root borne, which is the way Port Orford cedar root rot works. So there are some differences there, but some of the more general things, cleaning of equipment, cleaning of tools, works for growth for both species.
Have we found any resistant plants, Pano?
Not at this time, unfortunately, Chair Roblin.
Okay. Other questions? I appreciate the fact that you really said we're in a holding pattern, because we haven't really eradicated, and we haven't really got a way to eradicate. When we do burning after we clear cut, and we burn the area, does that kill the stuff in the soil?
Chair, to answer your question, it depends on how hot the burn was. The hotter the burn, of course, the deeper it goes in the soil. And if it goes deeply enough, it will affect any spores that may be down in the soil. If it's not a very hot burn, it's going to survive it.
So do we know, with respect to the biscuit fire, was there any in that area before? No, there wasn't. It looked like it was kind of just off the map. So
we're kind of sitting there. I hate to admit to you, kind of going just a little further. just more southeast, but it didn't quite get that far.
Okay. That's there. But California could open that opportunity later.
they have enough trees
on their forest. That's what I'm saying. I mean, they're in the same pattern of like electrical storm activity, so okay. They're setting themselves up for a nice fire.
Over 14 counties.
Over 14 counties?
Yes.
Yes,
Representative. Mr. Chair, just a side note, there are several of us probably on the committee that would happy to donate to a fund if Representative Clem would like to move to California and put on a change that eradication thing. We can start a fund tomorrow, Brian.
All right.
Any other questions?
Oh, I have one more
yes.
question. On the proposed expansion, who's the decision maker on whether allowing that expansion or not?
Representative Clem, to answer your question, that would fall on the Oregon Department of Agriculture and our hearings officer. I will say this, that we did present our proposal to the USDA national director, and he had been thinking about doing the whole county until we talked to him and showed him what we're doing in Curry County, but he has agreed that expansion looks adequate in their eyes as well.
Curry County, for whatever reason, it just amazes me. They also had a real issue with a blackberry disease.
Rust.
Yes. Are we doing reasonably well on that one as well?
Chair, to answer your question, Mother Nature took care of that for us. The weather conditions have not been conducive for the rust for the past couple of seasons, so it's really died down.
Okay. And that one scares me just because the industry, berry industry in our state, is a scary issue down there. It says unknown with respect to where it came from, this one. Other places in the world have it before us, or is this the only place that this has begun?
Chair, it also is found in Europe. There is actually a more aggressive strain of Phytophthora morum in Europe, and the federal regulations are theoretically in place to prevent that more aggressive strain from coming in. It's Phytophthora comes in two different mating types, an A1 and an A2, and we have the A2 type here. They have the A1 in Europe. So I'm not sure if that,
but is
how it relates. But
is this the only place A1 is?
Right now, the only place the A1 type is in Europe. We have picked it up a few times in nurseries in the U.S. on imported European stock, but otherwise we have not found it anywhere in the wild. In the wild, it's only the North American A2 type that we have.
And that's all over the U.S. or just in this area?
The only place we've got it in the wild in the U.S. is the 14 counties in California and the small area in Curry County.
Which means it'll spread.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, I guess. We really don't have a whole lot of public testimony. If there's anybody that wants to say anything at this time, they're certainly welcome to. But one thing I wanted to mention, we did give you a work plan in your stuff today for kind of the whole interim. And if, in fact, there's other things that you would like to have interest on there, it was developed from the last session's egg, the materials we didn't get through. We talked to people in our committee at the end and asked them if there were any things that they really wanted to consider, put that all together, and came up with this plan. And if so, if there's other issues you think that we need to, or things pop up that come up to you, please let us know. We've been semi-encouraged not to hand it out just because it changes a lot. And the issue is, it would be better, I think, to have you have the information, and then if there's things that come up, we'll change it because we can set an alert for those. But I appreciate the input from our committee before, and we have a few new members, so if there's other things on this list that you think would be of value over the next few months, let us know, and we'll certainly consider those. So, with that, any other issues or things you would like to bring up? Hearing none, we will adjourn this first meeting of the Ag and Natural Resource Committee.